Hi, I'm Femi Okay, and you're watching the stream coming to you today from my childhood bedroom in South London. The stories these walls could tell. Today's episode is all about stories as we focus in on the lessons that we can learn from sportswomen and sportsmen around the world. The inspiration is a new book called The Dilly Dong Bell, A Wake-Up Call for Sport by Lee Wellings. In it, Lee sees sport as an allegory for life. We are going to test out that premise by bringing together two sports journalists who we admire and respect to talk about ethics and sport. Lee Wellings, of course, and Shireen Ahmed. Welcome to the stream, both of you. Great to have you on board.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Pam.
I just wanted to tap into what you're thinking about right now. When was the last time Lee and Shireen you thought, that sports story, so like life? Instant reaction, instant thought. Lee, you go first.
Probably every day. Every time we see a story coming in the news that's leading the news, you think, here it is again, here it goes again. And these stories are around since I finished writing the book. I think, oh, if only I'd had time to put that story in as well. They're constant. And I'm constantly sort of evolving my view on sport, and stories in the news just keep on inspiring and also making you want to have other people discuss them and actually come to some conclusions about sport's role in society.
Shireen, life and sport going together so beautifully. When was the last time you said, just as in life?
I mean, it depends what aspect of life, really. I mean, there's challenges, there's struggles, there's joy. But, I mean, I work a lot in the intersections of race and gender in sport, and quite often my beat is not a happy one. So when we talk about struggles, particularly for women athletes or non-binary athletes, it happens quite often, whether it's an issue of abuse, whether it's an issue of inequality of pay. I mean, very specifically, on a fun note, I was having a very animated conversation with my colleagues at Burn It All Down this morning about the joy of Sadio Mane. And we were speaking about Senegalese football in the pre-show, but just having that to talk about joy. And now I try very hard to incorporate joy into some of my practice as a journalist. Otherwise, it would be very, very depressing. The world of sports, Femi, can be very depressing. So I try to insert that intentionally.
That is part of our conversation today. And I'm going to say to all of our viewers who are watching on YouTube, either the depressing, thoughtful part of sport, the joyful part of sport, whatever you want to share with us, the lessons you have learned. If you're on YouTube, jump into the comment section, be part of today's show. Let us start with CJ Thomas, who is a presenter for AFTV. We asked him earlier, what's the biggest issue for you right now? And this is what he told us.
So the biggest issue in my sport that I believe we're currently facing, and I believe this is in all levels of football, from the grassroots all the way through to the top leagues in the world, and from being an ex-player to working in sports media now, I personally feel this one, and I think the biggest issue for me is racism. I know I probably sound like a broken record, but you would have thought after the Euros for England, the three black players missing their penalties, and the abuse they got off the back of that, the campaigns that went in after that, things like kick out racism, sorry racism, the red card, the players taking a knee off before every match. You would have thought change would have been more clear in the game. But for me, it's just being spoken about more, but no actual punishment or change has actually happened. I think more needs to be done. And it's a big, big issue in the game that I hope is stamped out and taken seriously, more seriously going forward in football.
So what I'm thinking here, Lee, first of all, is George Floyd, what impact that made, the Black Lives Matter movement going globally, what impact that made on sport, on racism in sport? CJ there is not impressed. Lee?
Well, actually, sport made an impact back on society after that, because it was through things we saw in sport, from taking a knee at huge sports events and from discussions around whether the knee should be taken, through to, say, the actions which were commendable, I felt, of the players and the officials throughout the NBA, and sometimes refusing to play if that was a necessary action. I think that sport was instructing society in some ways on how to behave. And these things come from the top. I mean, I've said many times over the years, I've refused to go on as a reporter or correspondent and say, well, FIFA or UEFA has handed out a fine or a suspension or a stadium closure. So what? Kick a club out of a competition. Kick a nation out. I mean, not for a first minor offence, maybe. You know, you'd have legal difficulties then. But there needs to be strong action. It comes from the top. When in this country, on a sports programme here, many of which aren't fit for purpose, there was a discussion about racism and they tried to have a grown-up conversation. It didn't work because the grown-up amongst them started talking about it coming from the top and from government level, where taking a knee was frowned upon. They were shut down because, hang on, we're outside the sports bubble. Everyone is uncomfortable. I think that's disgraceful, and I think that's where it comes from the top. Yes, progress has been made from when I started reporting on football, crikey, at the end of the 80s, around 1990. We're in a different society now. But my goodness, there's still so much progress to be made and so much that we see on a daily basis that is wrong.
So I'm just going to jump in here and to say that I will agree to some parts that there has been progress made. But if you look at the demographics of football media, for example, it's white men. Where is the progress? I haven't seen enough racialized. Do you see sports journalists that look like me? So, in fact, who tells the story is as important as what the story is. And when we're confronting issues of racism or misogyny in those intersections, then I mean, I'm not trying to be cynical here, but let's be realistic about this. Also, I would like to quickly just tweak something that Lee had mentioned. It wasn't the NBA that stood up after the murder of George Floyd. It was actually the WNBA and Black women in that league that have set the blueprint for how anti-Black racism can be eradicated in sport. And let's not forget that, because that's one of the problems that happens. Black women are often excluded from these. And the first ally, the white ally, to kneel with Colin Kaepernick was, in fact, Megan Rapinoe, was a white gay woman. And she wasn't on the cover of Sports Illustrated. So let's be careful how we chronicle this and we remember it. So as much as I would say that there has been a catalyst in the murder of George Floyd was very instructive, it also made newsrooms and reporting rooms realize that they were badly equipped to handle discussions of racism. And, like, let's not even
get started
about...
Do you know how I realized, Shireen? Sorry to jump in. And I think you might agree with this. I'll tell you how they realized. I know for a fact how they realized. Because people were phoned by bosses at media organizations and said, we need to have a more diverse workforce after the murder of a Black man in America. And then
I got a phone call specifically for that reason, that they were like, I won't agree. It's my lived experience. So what my point was that these discussions need to be had. But it's not just about quickly hiring for a contract position and then laying off somebody because you're done with them. We haven't eradicated racism. This is not a post-racial thing. And I think media needs to be quite responsible and need to understand how they're complicit in these type of systems. I mean, people are still absolutely, you know, writing terrible things in British sport media in particular. You know, like, I think particular players get the ire. Particular players are, you know, dealt with. And women's sport is essentially not covered in the ways that it need to be. So let's be very honest about that when we
absolutely
talk about
it. Absolutely. But, Shireen, who's making the decisions? This is the thing. Don't you find we all fall into the trap of saying, oh, well, that looks like a diverse on-screen team. That looks like a diverse workforce. Hang on a minute. Who's making the decisions? Some of the people making the decisions will have terrible track records of diversity and just not making the right decisions anyway over many years. Mm-hmm. Now they're winning awards for their coverage of such things as Black Lives Matter and sport. But they're the same people that were in place.
Celine, if I may, some of what we're talking about isn't just the governing bodies of sport. It's not just the sports authorities. It's also how we as journalists and a sports correspondent handles stories. So, Shireen, I want you to have a listen to Erica. Erica is a freelance writer. She spoke to us a few hours ago. This is what she shared with us. And then immediately after Erica has finished, please tell us your thoughts.
One of the problems that I see in sports is truly the coverage. Generally speaking, sports journalists are either not encouraged to or not equipped to have conversations where sports intersects other integral parts of our life, relationships, or politics or education or advocacy and social justice. So my solution would be that first we hire more diverse journalists who are able to cover and interweave sports stories with some of these other things. My second solution is that we then train journalists ongoing to have these conversations in sports.
What a joy to see Ms. Erica Ayala, who has single-handedly created a media space called Black Rosie Media. And she's absolutely right. I mean, she's a colleague and a friend. She's an Afro-Latina. And I think she brings a different identity to a newsroom or to coverage. And I think that's imperative in someone that covers, you know, whether it's football, it's basketball or ice hockey, women's ice hockey. I think this is really important. And in addition to hiring a diverse journalist, what I'm looking for and what my, and as an instructor of journalism at Toronto Metropolitan University, I teach sport media and sport journalism. I'm not only encouraging my students to go be broadcasters and presenters, I would like them in decision-making rooms. I would like them as editors. I would definitely like them as producers, because the quality of the conversation that happens when you have racialized women as producers on a sports show is extremely different than if you don't. So I'm very, very clear on what my expectations are of my students, and to also be very honest with themselves. Do journalists have the ability to say, well, I'm going to amplify somebody else who doesn't look like me? I've never had that happen to me before, to be quite honest.
Shereen, that was the exact point I was making. I mean, that's literally the exact point I was making. So, you know, I mean, you're agreeing with me there. So I'm pleased, because, you know, there should be some agreement here, because we have different experiences, but we have many of the same views, because we're using our eyes, our ears and our brains. And not everyone in this industry, in fact, not hardly anyone in the sports industry sometimes, seems to be wanting to do this, seems to be wanting to go deeper. You can look at little examples like if hooliganism breaks out in a football stadium, I wanted to report on the match. No, that's the story now. You're going to have to deal with it. And one thing that really strikes me about you is that you're talking about, sort of paraphrase you, but, you know, creating spaces. And you say in your amazing, brilliant TED Talk, you're talking about you had to carve out roles for yourself, carve out a path. Will progress be when people don't have to do that, that actually they succeed because of a system rather than despite it?
So, Lee, I had a thought here, and this came from Liz Rainey on YouTube. And Liz Rainey said, yes, Shereen, I totally agree with you. Who tells the story matters. And there's a process of education that you discovered, Lee, as you were talking about and thinking about Serena Williams and an incident that happened in 2018. Very briefly, tell us that story and your learning curve on that story.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of writing this book was, you know, there's a bell thing. People in society need to listen more. So I just needed to listen to what was being said. And I needed to actually make sure that I spoke to people extensively who were affected sometimes more than me before I wrote anything. Now, I like to think that I've been bold and I've trailblazed during my career, which is now 30 years.
So Lee, tell us the story, because we know your work from Algebra.
Serena Williams. No, but it's important, the context here for me, because it's the one time, this is why I'm giving the context, it's the one time I bottled it. I was going to tweet to say that Serena Williams' behaviour was disgraceful. The reason I was going to do that was very simple, because it was. It was a tantrum, pure and simple. No difference, really, from a John McEnroe tantrum. You know what? Tennis players are prone to that, just as tennis umpires are prone to being pompous. But I bottled it, and the reason is it would have been, I promise you, misconstrued. Because the amount of vile racism that's directed at my favourite tennis player, Serena, who I've covered her entire career and have so much admiration and know her background and know her backstory, we had virtue signalling, patronising, condescending journalists, lauded journalists, who were telling us, well, look, there's the backstory, look what happened. That night I felt sorry for Naomi Osaka, and in the book I talk about how it was her night, it was ruined, and what was happening here was the right subject that needs to be in the public eye all the time, but the wrong case. I have gone to friends, black friends, people in the media, people outside of the media, and said, do I have the right to to say this? Do I have the right to write about it? And the answer I've got, because I've listened, is that, Lee, when you've experienced enough of this, you quickly come in for Serena because you know what's coming towards her.
Shereen, thoughts?
Well, I mean, as somebody who identifies very specifically as a racialized journalist, my experience will be different than Lee. I don't need to ask source and ask friends. I can just look within my own experience. And the way that I would have spoken of Serena is quite differently. I would look at my position and my privilege and look at the history of misogynoir against her in the tennis media. I would look at the battle she's faced in terms of maternal black health. I would look at the way that she boycotted a specific tournament because of the way her family was treated. And I would still look at that. But then more importantly, I think I would have deferred to other black sports journalists. And I would amplify their work instead of having to inject.
What about what she's doing on the night, Shereen? This is
okay,
the problem.
So I understand.
That
Lee,
it's the
just
right
let me,
subject, but you
Lee,
still
let me finish here.
Respond.
I think that there's a different, and you aside, I think there's a different way in which tennis media and sports media holds her to account. I can think of many different black athletes, be it tennis, be it ice hockey, where black and racialized athletes are held to a different standard. And I don't necessarily feel that it's like required for me to add on to that. But like I said, and I will stick by this, I will amplify other racialized journalists who have lived experience in a window that I don't. And that's something that I believe is missing in the industry. It won't hurt me or my paycheck if I defer to somebody with lived experience on this issue. So part of my personal practice as a journalist is to amplify even more marginalized sports journalists who may be black, who may have profound things to say about her technique, about the mechanics, about the skill, but also about the context of what's happening here. And I think that's something that's missing greatly from sports journalism. There's too much ego. It's not about whether you, Lee, personally can write about it. It's whether the story is shared in a way that's responsible and incorporates harm reduction and is fair to the subject. Our job as reporters is to report fairly and accurately and what we do. But also part of that and what I teach my students is to amplify people in the margins, which is part of the entire problem of sports media industry. It's not about white men with power talking about issues of substance for minorities. It's about whether those people in the margins have a right to share their own experiences and do the same work.
And white men with power in that case were virtue signaling to within an inch of their lives. It was really ghastly to see because actually it meant there was no nuance. There was no really proper research into what was going on. It was just telling the backstory. And actually, I think that that night deserved more than that, because what I've tried to do in the book, and hopefully I've achieved this, is actually give the full context, talk about the background where Serena's faced things like not getting endorsements because she's not a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Russian who was nowhere near as good a tennis player as her.
I'm going to
give
them
that backstory,
like,
but then
to...
on the night...
No. I hear you. And Shereen as well. Shereen, I want to tap into your lived experience because it means that you can tell stories about sport that we're not necessarily getting from other sports journalists. I'm going to show an image, and this image is of a Moroccan hurdler who in the 1980s caused so many little girls in Morocco to be called Nawal. Can you tell us Nawal's story? It is a fabulous story, and one thanks to you that I know. Share it with our audience and why it's important.
And thank you, Femi, for that. And this is the part of joy that I'm happy that I get to. I get inspired by my co-hosts at Burn It All Down, Dr. Mira Rose Davis and Dr. Brenda Elsie, and I've picked up a bit of a historian bug. Nawal El-Moutakhawil was the first woman from North Africa, Arab Muslim woman, who won a gold in the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles in the hurdles. And, you know, I think that when I study and when I write and when I research, my master's degree is on Muslim women in sports specifically, but in self-representation. But when I was doing my research, and also when I report on Muslim women in sports, for which I'm a global expert, people would say, oh, Muslim women are oppressed, they need to be submissive. You know, I remind them of this history, and the story of Nawal El-Moutakhawil is so special because not only was the king of Morocco so excited by her gold medal win, there was a phone brought to the side, and remember, this is 1984, there's no cordless phone, so it was like stretched.
Those phones were big!
Yeah, those phones were massive, and it was stretched out to the track. She got on the phone, and she had the flag around her, and the king of Morocco was so overjoyed that he declared that every baby born on that day would be named Nawal. So if you meet someone who's close to 40 around that, and their name is Nawal. Maybe perhaps they were born on that day during the Summer Games. And, you know, this isn't to gloss over the fact that there all are contradictions and struggles in Muslim majority countries. And, you know, I don't shy away from any of those criticisms in my work. But it also is important not to paint all groups monolithically. Muslims are not a monolith. Neither are Muslims in the sports space. And this is the problem with not having enough people that look like myself to be able to report, is that you get one lens. You get one perspective. And that's what I'm arguing for here, is that there needs to be more. And then my job, not only as a journalist, is to create those spaces, not just for myself. What was the point of me being at a table if I can't invite others to join? So I've decided to create my own dining room. I'm sick of the old table. I don't want to sit at that table. I'm creating my own. And I think whoever wants to come in the margins, whoever wants to be mentored, who wants to be in the space, I reside in Canada, but I have global contacts. And this is, I want to see a shifting globally of this.
What I hear is an activist, a campaigner, an advocate for sport in all of its diversity. I'm going to show one image here, Shereen, just very briefly. Tell us why it gives you joy before I move on to an incredible story from Leicester City. But this, who is this team? Who is this beautiful team of men?
You want to talk about joy and providence. This is the Canadian men's national football
Goodness
team. This is the Canadian men's
what
team.
What fine athletes.
Who wonderful, absolutely, you know, bring passion and bring purpose and bring happiness to the pitch. Now, the reason this is a compelling team, like unlike the Canadian women's football team, which won gold at the Olympics in Tokyo, this particular team had not qualified for the men's World Cup. And I please recall that and note that I'm using men's, because it's important to say men's and women's to distinguish, not to use the men's as the standard. So this particular team has qualified for the men's World Cup in Qatar in 2022 for the first time since 1986. So this is, you know, the country is excited about that. We know that our women's players are heroes. They're top of the podium. And we're hoping that the attention to the men and hopefully will bring money stream and revenue stream to the women who are not yet paid equally. So I'm hopeful for many reasons.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hope, joy, and oh my goodness, celebration. I am going to end on a celebration. I'm going to take you back to May 2016, 6 years ago, almost to the day. This was Lee reporting at Al Jazeera.
Sports fans across the globe have never seen anything like this. It seems now, an hour or two after they've clinched the title, that the entire city of Leicester, including this moment, maybe should be in bed, have come to the stadium and they've come to say we've done it. We are the champions. Excitement cannot be canned. 132 years this club has been going, and what an achievement, beating all the big boys.
I'm terribly sorry, Lee. I hope you can hear me, but I think in true footballing style, you should elbow your way to the front.
Here I come. Gangway. There we go.
Good boy.
David.
There wasn't a question. I just wanted to see if you could make it.
All right. In 1 minute. That baby's now 6 years old. Part of history. Love it. We only have 1 minute left, so I'm going to ask you to crystallise in a sentence that story about Leicester City winning the Premier League in a sentence, Lee. What would you say?
Central story of the book. Joy, fun, the biggest sports miracle ever, a kind, empathetic leader. It was just a beautiful thing for a city. There was magic in the air. I've never seen a bigger sports miracle. And when I give children's career speeches, I press play on that and they laugh and they get it. And that's what
love
sport
it,
should
love
be.
It,
and that's
love it. Lee Wellens is the author of The Dilly Dong Bell, A Wake Up Call for Sport. Shereen Ahmed, oh my goodness, she's a teacher. She's a sports journalist. She's an inspiration. Do check out her column on CBS. Called Joy Drop as well. I'm Femi Okeh. Thanks for watching the stream today. Take care. I'll see you next time.